Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Monday morning. So before I introduce my first fabulous guest, who I always love going to because whatever he covers, I know you need to know. A couple of things. Last night on Sunday night, because remember we record on Monday morning, I went to a vigil that was recognizing the death of the young transgender person in Oklahoma. And it was from 5:30 to 6:30. It was a candlelight vigil. This is New Hampshire. I wasn't sure who was going to show up. And I went to the event. And first of all, let me tell you, there were so many people there. I could not believe it. There was just so many people at this vigil in front of the State House. It was a wonderful evening. Everyone got up to tell their stories. And a lot of the stories are just heartbreaking. But they were so powerful and so important. And I almost wish everyone could just be there to listen. I am so glad I went. And again, I just want people to know, these are human beings. We're all struggling to figure out who we are. We all are. And just to hear how intense the struggle is and to hear a mother talk about her trans child, I don't know, just love people. All right, just understand people, accept them, and love them. That's all I ask. And then before we grab our first guest, Alex Salmon, who writes for Slate.com, I wanted to just share a really quick quote. If you're going to speak truth to power, you should at least tell the truth. That sounds like normal. This is from Professor Paul Offit. And who is Professor Offit talking about? He's talking about RFK Jr. and how anti-vaccine misinformation has shaped his truth-teller candidacy. You've got to read the article. It's at the BBC. Oh my God, Paul Offit absolutely, he despises RFK Jr. because he was there to share the facts and the truth and the information about vaccines. And then everything he told them was then distorted and turned around. Again, if you're going to speak truth to power, you should at least tell the truth. All right, joining us right now is one of my favorite people. He now writes for Slate.com. I first met him when he was writing for the American Prospect. Alex Salmon, welcome back to the program. Your two articles, I should have been in a padded room when I read them because I was so upset. But that's why you write for Slate.com, because you share the information that if we didn't know it, maybe it would be fine. But knowing it just makes you that much more frustrated. So thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be here.
So I'm going to start with the first one. And the first one, just I got to read the opening paragraph just because I read it and I actually called four friends and I read them the opening paragraph. Honest to God, I called four different people. I'm like, I can't contain myself. The title of Alex's piece that was written on March 1st was Democrats Blew Their Big Opportunity to Make New York Winnable in 2024. Now, last time I checked, isn't the minority leader, is he from New York? And isn't the Republican leader in the Senate from New York? I just want to make sure I got the right people in the right state. Am I right about this, Alex?
Yeah, the Democratic leader in the Senate. Yeah, yes, both of our Democrats in the House and the Senate at the top are from New York.
Okay. I just want everyone to hold that on the back wall as I read your opening paragraph. And then you can like hold my hand and explain to me what the H happened. Here we go. After over a year in court, millions of dollars on lawyers' fees, an overhaul of the state's highest court, and an all-out battle to throw out New York's congressional districts and replace them with something more favorable for Democrats. The New York legislature, empowered with the ability to flip control of the House single-handedly, voted to confirm new maps signed by the governor into law. The result? The number of Trump-won districts in the state has officially increased from 5 to 6. Read that again, not a typo. The number of Trump won districts in the state has officially increased from 5 to 6. And that is not a typo. Okay, Alex, I'm on the couch. My pulse has gone up. I'm trying to be fine here. So explain to me, Alex, what the hell happened? How did this happen? Oh my God, I'm so frightened about 2024. And then I read this and I'm like, we are putting up barriers to winning over and over again. The Republicans get an inch and they take 12 miles. We get 12 miles, we don't even take an inch. I mean, just amazing. And I mean, if everybody was playing fair and if people were speaking the truth and if facts mattered and issues mattered, I might like be a little more forgiving, But none of that is true. And then I read your article. So explain to my audience a little bit of the background of how we got here, more importantly, and then explain exactly what happened.
Yeah, so it's been this sort of ongoing battle about these congressional districts in New York, which it, you know, seems like pretty small stuff, but turned out to be a really big plot line in the midterms in 2022. New York Democrats obviously face planted, did terribly, sort of defied the entire nationwide trend line with how badly they did. And they lost four seats that were, you know, flipped from blue to red, and, you know, almost cost Democrats the House single-handedly, right? The majority of Republicans was only ever five seats. So, and the story that emerged in the aftermath of that, both in the lead up, I guess, to that election and in the aftermath, was that these horrible congressional districts were to blame, that they, New York Democrats, sort of at the behest of Governor Andrew Cuomo, had engaged on this entirely misguided quest to get rid of partisan gerrymandering. The result was this, you know, ridiculous commission, the Independent Redistricting Commission, that was unable to really do the job. And the result of that was they had to get an out-of-state special master to draw up the maps, and the maps were incredibly favorable to Republicans. It was sort of what the line was. Democrats, yes, they face-planted, but they face-planted because this out-of-state egghead who was, you know, sort of more favorable to Republicans drew up this dreamy scenario for the GOP, and that's why they won. And so, against all odds, actually, in the aftermath of this, Democrats realized that there was maybe a loophole here and that they could sue to get the maps thrown out and get a do-over. And for the last year and a half, it's actually gone basically according to plan. It's sort of amazing. They sued. In the process of suing, they actually had to flip the court. I mean, we've talked about this before. They flipped New York's highest court from a conservative majority to a liberal majority, which means they basically changed the refs and to a much more amenable group here. And it all sort of seemed like it was coming together. Like 2 weeks ago, I wrote a piece that was like, here we go. Like, this is it. It's finally going to happen.
And then what happened? And then, I read that piece from 2 weeks ago. This is 2 weeks later. It's like, excuse me, are you looking at 2024? Are you looking at the climate crisis? Are you looking at democracy? Are you looking at the war in Ukraine? Are you looking at, I mean, everything that is on the line? And then what happened?
Yeah, and this is the classic thing. It's like you know, it's like a toddler. You take your eye off him for 10 seconds and all of a sudden the house is on fire. Yeah, even I thought, like, all right, the procedure was going according to plan. There were all these intermediate steps. The redistricting commission got one more chance to revise the maps. They basically didn't change them at all. And the read on that from me and many others was, okay, well, they're not even trying because they know the Democrats are going to gerrymander these districts, at least in a way that's slightly more favorable for Democrats, right? And the entire forecast on the House control for 24 is based on, like, Democrats are going to get four or five seats back just on this redraw alone. They vote down the maps. The responsibility is sent to the New York legislature, supermajority control with Democrats. And in a matter of just like a couple of hours, they draw up these maps that are basically indistinguishable from the 2022 maps. And actually, the only real way they're distinguishable, they make one, there are two districts that get bluer. One is New York's third, which is already held by Tom Suozzi, who won a few weeks ago. They just made his life easier. They shored up his incumbency. And then New York 22 got slightly bluer, which was already going to be the easiest one for Democrats to win. And they actually, in the process of doing so, this incumbency protection racket, they end up making the map actually redder. So we go from having 21 districts that Biden won in 2020 to now there are only 20 districts that he won. And even the most favorable analysis here says that, like, maybe Democrats pick up a half seat on this. But really, like, the New York's 19th district, which is a swing district that they really were hoping to win, they made that redder. They made New York's first district, which is another swing district they were hoping to win. That got way redder. It's probably out of reach now. And the legislature passed it, and the governor signed it, and Hakeem Jeffries said it was fantastic. And it all happened in, like, a couple of hours.
What drug are they on? I mean, and let me just show you that the Democrats are there's something wrong with them. Okay, there really is something wrong with them, because I'm going to read again from your article, because this is how you know how bad it is. New York Republicans can't believe their great luck. Republican House Rep Nicole Malaticus, whatever her name, posted her new district lines on X beneath the caption, "Hello, gorgeous." She's looking at the map of her district. Hello, gorgeous. New York 17th district remains largely unchanged. GOPer Michael Lawler tweeted with glee, "Republicans who are almost certainly going to sue over the legislature's map and were preemptively crying foul announced upon seeing it that, oh my God, we're going to bring no legal contest to this." Numerous state Republicans across both chambers, of course, voted in favor. They're like high-fiving. They're calling their wives. They're calling their children. They're actually planning what kind of drapes they're going to have. I mean, it's just, I can't, but then Hakeem Jeffries said this was good. Good for whom? Good for whom? He needs warm bodies. He doesn't need half a district. There is no such thing as half a district. It's like being partially pregnant. I mean, it's like, what are we talking about? I am just so disgusted and appalled. And I'm like, you know what? If people were playing fair, maybe, maybe. But this is such a lopsided, you know, situation across the country, let alone in New York. But then this is the kicker. The kicker is, oh, but don't worry, we're going to spend a lot of money. And you end with the story about the money. So share with my audience how much money they're talking about spending, but put it into perspective with what they just spent on Long Island.
Right, right. So yeah, you know, your enemies will tell you all you need to know about yourself sometimes. And like when this new maps got passed, Republicans were so happy. Like the Nicole Malliotakis tweet, right, celebrating her district line. She tweeted out the actual, she tweeted the map. Like she just tweeted the district lines. Disbelief about how favorable this worked out for her, for her Republican colleagues. And right. So the story that we were told prior to this was, well, the New York Democratic Party sucks, but with these more favorable maps, it will paper over the fact that there's this deep structural and infrastructural inadequacy in the party. Well, that went out the window with the new maps, which, you know, are worse, arguably worse than ever. And so now the news story is that, like, well, the Democratic Party is going to spend an absolute boatload of money to overcome these structural inadequacies and now the structural disadvantage of these maps. And so they earlier last year pledged $45 million in spending from the National Party to help win these five House seats in New York that they had targeted at the top of the list. They hired staffers for New York specifically. So they sort of built this little shadow party inside of the state, which sounds fine. It sounds promising and useful. But then you look at how much they spent just on the special election in New York's third district to replace George Santos, which, again, can you imagine a better matchup than running to replace George Santos? It doesn't get any easier than that.
Exactly.
And they spent $15 million on that race.
Just that race. Think about that. And he was running against a woman who was a Republican, but she wasn't. She was a registered Democrat who had been basically pulled into the Republican side. I mean, you can't, who had a thin resume. I mean, everything I learned about her is like, oh my God, how could you possibly have been even worried about this contest? So not only was he replacing someone who was toxic waste, you know, in a place where there was so much momentum to actually probably vote for a Democrat, but then when you realize the amount of money that they overspent and overkilled in order for him to win, and then you look at the $45 million, I'm like, we do math too. We understand too. And everything you have done is to shoot yourself in the foot, but you're not just hurting New York. You're hurting the country. You're not just hurting New York, because you know we're talking about congressional seats. Congressional seats may represent a state, but in the end, they vote for a country and they hurt us. And now, has anyone gotten a real answer from Hakeem after your article? Because I want to go back to Hakeem and say, so like, what were you selling? Because I'm not exactly buying it.
Right. It's really confusing, because you have to say, like the comparison that I think was very apt, one of the people I spoke to for this article, David Neer at the Daily Coast Elections website, said that, like, I mean, just on a fundamental level, if the House Minority Leader was a Republican, let's say, and he was Republican from North Carolina, let's say, and he had a chance to redistrict the state, he would tell his incumbents, hey, look, for the good of the party, for the good of the party nationally, and for our ability to control this thing, you're going to get tighter districts. We're going to gerrymander your districts, and you're going to be in slightly more competitive races. And we're going to go from, say, what North Carolina just did, went from a 7-7 split, a 50-50 electorate. They tore their maps up and got an 11-3 Republican advantage. And they did that without breaking a sweat. For Hakeem to not say that to his own representatives in New York, who surely understand what's at stake, to not be like, all right, this is not an incumbent protection racket. We have the entire, you know, stake of the stakes are in control of the House nationally. And my role as Speaker, to not do that, makes basically no sense in terms of even just a sort of self-invested, self-interested sort of campaign. And yeah, the justification we got from him prior to these maps being signed into law was I think pretty confounding. It was sort of talking about how there are fewer counties that are split in half or bisected multiple times by congressional district lines. But of course, like, you know, even that didn't really stand up to the analysis because there are actually more split counties on this map than there were in the 22 map. As if that was something to aspire to anyways. I mean, that is, you know, imagine where that ranks on the list of concerns. I mean, it can't be very high.
Oh, you've got to get this to John Stewart. I mean, somebody's got to like rip this apart. I just like, it can't just be Arnie and Alex. It's got to be like the world needs to know this. I'm so angry. And again, the idea of protecting incumbents does not protect democracy. And that's what they did. They protected incumbents and did not protect democracy. There is a difference, everyone. Trust me, I've been around the block. All right. All right. Now, before I let you go, you wrote a piece about Emily's List. And as I mentioned to you, I actually posted your piece. Is Emily's List Republican now? And I posted it on my Facebook page. You should just go and read Alex's piece at slate.com. But if you happen to like frequent my Facebook page, I posted it this way. I have hated Emily's List for decades. My personal story only adds to my revulsion. But that is a story for another time. Just read this. And I repeat, don't send money to these folks. They have done more harm to women and the Democratic Party for years. And now this, pathetic. So explain to my audience what the H Emily's List is doing. Emily's List stands for Early Money is Like Yeast. It is a pro-choice Democratic group. They want women. They want pro-choice. But ultimately, they want to ensure that there are Democratic majorities in order to accomplish the pro-choice things they care about, the women's issues they care about. So they have to be pretty sophisticated in what they do. And I've always questioned that since I've had a personal relationship with them, but that was 1992. We're now talking 2024. So explain to my audience why Emily's List is not getting better, but in some ways maybe getting worse. What exactly did they do in this cycle that should offend so many people that actually care about democracy, that actually care about women, that actually care about pro-choice? Because in a lot of ways, what they did undermined so much of that agenda.
Yeah, so far they had a really confusing, I mean, I would charitably say, had a very confusing cycle. And so, you know, we've from the beginning, we've heard, right, abortion is on the ballot. It's, you know, it's a pro-choice election. It's, you know, the stakes couldn't be higher on this particular issue. Where we've seen Emily's List get involved so far, there have been numerous races where they've waded in ways that critics have said are helping Republicans. And there are numerous examples of this. There's a race in California where Democrats are really hoping to flip a Republican held House seat. They recruited a candidate who's a Democrat, and then sort of promptly bailed on her once she got in the race. They didn't endorse her, but they showed her maps, you know, saying that she could win. And now the Democrats are freaking out because they're splitting the vote in this race, and Democrats might get locked out of the top two, which in California is all important because they have a jungle primary system. So that's one crisis. They endorsed Tammy Murphy in the New Jersey Senate. And Tammy Murphy, of course, has a lifelong voting record of voting for Republicans and anti-choice politicians. And yet they endorsed her despite that record in this very contentious New Jersey primary. But the biggest race, I think, is most important is California's 47th district, which is this House race. And there we've actually seen this sort of unbelievable alliance between Emily's List and this super PAC that's affiliated with AIPAC, the Israel lobby, which is funded.
The conservative Israeli lobby that's planning on spending millions and millions of dollars to aid and promote Bibi Netanyahu, that is basically going to destroy Joe Biden because Joe Biden doesn't understand that in a lot of ways, Bibi is Trump all the Israeli style. And so when you hear AIPAC, don't think Israel, think the destruction of America. And we can actually blame Bibi for this. So tell everyone about this relationship between AIPAC and this race.
Right. So there's AIPAC has this super PAC called United Democracy Project, and it claims to be sort of a democratic oriented super PAC. But I went through the FEC filings of this PAC, and they the top donors are overwhelmingly Republicans. I mean, we're talking Republican mega donors, billionaires, Trump, you know, it's mega Trump donors, Giuliani donors, Nikki Haley backers, McConnell donors. I mean, you go on the list, it's just one after the next, right? So it's Republican money. It's a Republican funded organization and one that supports anti-choice politicians. Very straightforward. Not only did they donate to Emily's list recently, but they also have been spending in this particular race seemingly in tandem. So they've spent $4.5 million so far. The mailers that they're putting out have Emily's List logo on them. They have the Emily's List slogan on them. Oh. I asked Emily's List if they're coordinating with this Republican-led super PAC. They refused to comment. I asked them why they accepted money from a Republican-funded group like this. They again refused to comment. The result is that you have this pro-choice women's organization spending massively against the Democratic frontrunner in this race, who has 100% rating from Planned Parenthood and who actually helped co-author the constitutional amendment in California last year that codified abortion rights into the state constitution. So a candidate with this unimpeachable record on choice, and they're spending to hurt him in Congress with this Republican group. And this is in a swing district, right? This is in a swing district where Republicans are put this at the top of the list for them to flip. They really want to win this race. And it seems like there's almost no other way to look at this without saying that, like, Emily's List, this pro-choice organization, is helping Republicans turn this district from a blue district into a red one.
It's I'm going to again read from your incredibly well-sourced article. And you write, here's where it gets weird. Women Vote PAC, Emily's List Super PAC, has also spent substantially in the race and is boosting Weiss to the disadvantage of Min. Weiss is a weaker candidate than Min, to put it charitably. Never held elective office. Doesn't live in the district. Wait a minute, let me sit that down. Wait, she's never held elective office. She doesn't live in the district. Her financial disclosures show basically zero income over the past handful of years. Yes, she is pro-choice, whoopee-doo, which is good, but again, has never held elective office and has a much shorter track record on pro-choice issues than Min, who sports, you ready, everyone? 100% rating from Planned Parenthood, co-authored the state's constitutional amendment that codified abortion and contraception access in 2022. It is the only race Women Vote PAC has spent in so far this year to the tune of, sitting down, $813,000. Emily's List announced it would spend at least $1 million on the race. So they're propping up this weak candidate who doesn't live in the district, who doesn't have the reputation. Here you've got this candidate who is adored by the pro-choice community. Completely, I mean, they understand, and yet what are they doing? Are they really supporting Weiss, or is this kind of a bait and switch? It looks like a Weiss endorsement, but ultimately it is exactly what AIPAC wants, which is the Republican to win. And they are the handmaidens to AIPAC. It is pathetic. It is pathetic. And there was no response from them?
Yeah, they did not. I put a series of questions to them, very specific, a number of them. And they refused to weigh in on any of them. They said, basically, we support pro-choice and pro-women candidates. That's what we do. You know, given the circumstances, I don't know if it's a terribly persuasive explanation for, you know, what's going on. It's honestly not the first time. It's rare to see the size of the donation from this super PAC, from this AIPAC affiliated super PAC to Emily's List was notable for me. We hadn't seen that before, but we've seen this in cycles in the past too, where they've spent, you know, against Democratic candidates who have really unimpeachable records on choice, and sometimes in concert with AIPAC and their priorities. it's not something we haven't seen before, but it is in a swing district, I think, so critical here. To spend that much to weaken the Democratic frontrunner means that, you know, Republicans are licking their lips. I mean, they couldn't be more happy about this outcome.
Right. This is another hello, gorgeous.
Yeah.
That's what this is, Alex, to quote a New York Republican. Anyway, Alex Salmon, you must read everything he writes at Slate.com because he's always giving you the stuff you're like, oh, you're kidding. Oh, you're kidding. Oh, you're kidding. The most recent piece, What's Happening to Emily's List? This election cycle, the group has waded into races in ways that threaten to help Republicans and hurt Democrats. Yes, this is your Democratic Party. Anyway, thank you, Alex, so much for joining us. I so appreciate what you do, and I'm so glad that you get time to share with me. Anyway, we will talk soon. Ciao.
Sounds great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back, folks.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. As was widely expected, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that no state can push Donald Trump off the ballot because he is an insurrectionist. Regardless of what you think or what I think about the merits of the case, this was never going to go any other way. Donald Trump was always going to be able to be on the ballot. And what troubles me is that there was a period, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, when a lot of otherwise very thoughtful and smart people really believed that this was going to save us. That somehow the justice system was going to make, in many respects, the right call and not allow Trump, who is an insurrectionist, to run again. Because if he runs and wins, he will once again try to destroy American democracy and indeed the United States. But the courts were never going to do that. And this is a pattern we see over and over where so many who understand the threat that Trump represents keep grasping at these straws. Mueller will save us. The midterms will save us. The courts will save us. The 25th Amendment will save us. The Insurrection Act will save us. The courts will save us. The courts will save us. The courts will save us. There is no deus ex machina that is going to save us here. What is going to save the American people and American democracy is the American people and American democracy. The only way we address this and we fix this is by beating him in November. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Scott, Stephanie Collins, we continue to record on Monday morning. As many of you know, I know a lot about Iowa. I know a lot about Iowa. Why? Because my daughter went to the University of Iowa. I know a lot about Iowa because I went to St. Olaf College, where a lot of my roommates came from Iowa. I know a lot about Iowa because my first husband's mother was an Iowa farm girl. And I know a lot about Iowa because many, many, many years ago, Professor Stefan Schmidt, who's also known as Dr. Politics from Iowa State, invited me to join him on Iowa Public Radio to cover the caucus and the primary. And then for the next almost 10 or 12 years, I was doing Iowa Public Radio on a regular basis, covering national politics through the lens of Iowa and New Hampshire. And I've never let go because I've decided that if I need to understand what the conservative Republican Party wants to do and what's their agenda, there are three states I really need to focus on. And those three states are Texas, yes, Greg Abbott, Florida, yes, Ron DeSantis, and Iowa, yes, Governor Reynolds. And so it was not surprising when a good friend of mine said, did you see that there is a complaint that's being filed against a state rep in Iowa? I'm like, yeah, what's a complaint? And then when she began to tell me more about it, I'm like, uh-oh, I think we need to learn a little bit more about this story. So we are being joined by two folks that belong to an organization known as Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. It is a statewide grassroots people's action group that uses community organizing to win public policy, that puts communities before corporations and people before profits, politics and polluters. It has been fighting to put people first for over 45 years. It's now a really tough slog given how Republican Iowa has become. But let me welcome two of their longtime organizers and members. Hugh Espy is a longtime member of the Iowa CCI staff team. He's played different roles in the organization since its start in 1979. He was a neighborhood organizer, farm project director, and most recently the executive director from 2003 to 2023. He's now a senior advisor. Let me welcome Hugh to the program. Hugh, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Arnie. We appreciate you reaching out and having us on the air with you.
It's a pleasure. And joining Hugh is Tim Glazer. He joined CCI staff team in 2017 as a canvas director, now works as a special projects director with a focus on public education. He grew up in Waterloo, Iowa, graduated from Iowa State University, served in the Peace Corps in Zambia, and has been a community organizer in North Dakota and Montana. Thank you, Tim, for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's great. So I'm going to go with the old man first, Tim. So forgive me for this. Hugh's been around since like dirt. All right. So Hugh, explain to us a little bit about the relationship between Governor Reynolds and the concept of undermining public education using the concept of vouchers. In a lot of ways, she has been the template for what a lot of other Republican governors have realized they need to do in order to not only serve up vouchers, but to make that sure that vouchers are wildly successful and that the kind of unlimited public dollars that goes into vouchers will not only aid and abet private schools and religious schools, but it will really dismantle public education in a much faster fashion. So tell us a little bit, Hugh, about Reynolds and this voucher scheme.
I'll give you a quick synopsis, and Tim's got more information about it. But essentially, Governor Reynolds, she's tried to pass the voucher program in 2021 and in 2022, and she was unsuccessful both years. In fact, in 2022, even though she has a Republican House and a Republican Senate to work with, there was pushback from rural Republicans in the House and the Senate to both programs, recognizing that cutting funding to public schools is going to hurt rural communities in particular. It's going to hurt all schools, but rural schools in particular. Rural schools, school districts, public school districts are some of the biggest economic engines in rural Iowa. They create jobs and they help teach our children and prepare us for adult life. So in 2022, when she could not get her voucher plan passed, she ended up primarying four of the Republican legislators who were blocking the voucher program. And so she ran, she endorsed Republicans who were running against Republicans in a primary in June of 2022. Dean Fisher happened to be one of those four that she endorsed, and he defeated an anti-voucher Republican in the primary quite handily. We would say quite handily because of Reynolds' endorsement. And then, of course, he went on in the fall to win the general election. So I'll stop right there for a second. So she was having trouble passing it. She primaried people in her own party, defeated them, got pro-voucher Republicans elected. And then in 2023, the legislature passed the voucher program within about the first 2 or 3 weeks. It was one of the first big things they did. Boom, lickety-split, got it passed.
So
and Dean Fisher was all part of that.
Right. So Hugh, we'll toss it to him, but you are just describing what we are now seeing happening in Texas, because Governor Greg Abbott is basically take a look at her GPS and her road plan and her roadmap of what she needed to do to make sure she could go into a primary the way Greg Abbott is going into primaries, basically making sure that all those rural Republicans who are anti-vouchers get primaried. And then, of course, Greg Abbott, who's wildly popular in Texas, doesn't even talk about the voucher bills when he goes into those primary districts. He'll talk about the border, he'll talk about guns, as if that's the reason why he wants these Republicans out in the primary, because he doesn't want to mention the voucher word, because the vouchers are why those Republicans were elected in the first place, because they oppose vouchers. So it's so interesting, which is why, again, I tell people, I go to Iowa, I go to Florida, I go to Texas, because what happens in Iowa doesn't stay in Iowa. And Greg Abbott is basically doing exactly the same thing that you were just describing. Now, Tim, before we can like now move into what's happening with the vouchers and about this state rep that Governor Reynolds embraced and won, I want to read some headlines as I was getting ready for this conversation from Iowa. So here are four headlines. 62% of Iowans oppose Governor Kim Reynolds' private school scholarship law, Iowa poll finds. That's 62% oppose the vouchers, okay? So we know from a Democratic perspective, it ain't so Democratic, because 62% of the people don't even buy it. And that's just not rural Iowans. It's across the board. So that's 62%. Here's a second headline for you, Tim. Price tag for Reynolds' voucher program could hit $221 million. It may even be more than that, but you can hold my hand and tell me. How about this one? Iowa school voucher applications surpass expectations. Cost likely to follow. And then my favorite, Tim, is the following. Two-thirds of students who received a private school voucher in Iowa this year were already enrolled in private school. All right. So this wasn't an expansion of an opportunity. It was just a payback to people using public dollars to basically say to people who are already cutting checks, not a problem. We'll give you the cash. It's just amazing. So, Tim, so tell me what is going on, because we now know that the voucher bill is alive and well. It's wildly, unfortunately, not successful necessarily with the voters, but wildly successful to people that want some checks. So tell me a little bit about why you have this ethics complaint, and lead us and hold our hand to how we got to this ethics complaint, because I think in some ways it should be a made for TV movie. It's like it's like so gross, but so obvious on its face. Anyway, Tim, tell my audience what's going on.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the vouchers are incredibly unpopular, and there's other things Reynolds is doing on public education. She's cutting our special education. She's banning books. You know, she's cutting funding to our public schools. She's not listening to the people in Iowa. And when it comes to filing the ethics complaint, you know, it's just clear that this is wrong. Representative Fisher is failing to uphold the honor and the integrity of the legislature. That, you know, that's in the House rules on ethics. So we filed this complaint because it's wrong, and we want Iowa to see this is how the vouchers are going to play out. You know, this
they
is
don't
just
know
the
what
first
they don't know
year.
What Fisher has done. So we know that Fisher replaced an anti-voucher Republican. We yeah. know that basically Governor Reynolds has embraced Fisher, but you now have to give us the little bit of the course of history, because he's just a Republican who voted for vouchers, which is what a lot of Republicans do. They get elected. Their whole purpose is to dismantle public education, and they vote for vouchers. But there's something really a little more smelly about the behavior of Dean Fisher. He just ain't a Republican voting for vouchers. He's taken it to a level, and to a, really a level of almost corruption that I think people need to hear, because there was an alternative purpose. He didn't just want to serve in the Iowa legislature. He wanted to do something else. So share with my audience, Tim, exactly what Dean did, because it didn't exist before he got elected, but it clearly existed after he got elected.
Yeah, so Fisher, he campaigned on the vouchers, he voted for them, and now he wants to cash in. So shortly after the vouchers pass, Fisher and some people in his community started their own private religious school. And he has said that, they plan to open this school in 2025, and they want to use vouchers to pay the bulk of their operating costs. So this is about $1 million a year of public dollars that will go to fund Fisher's private school. So he's planning to have about 120 students at the school. And if all of those students get vouchers, that's, I think it's like $916,000 just in 1 year. And so he's using his political power, his, public position for private gain. And we think that's wrong.
Well, so in a lot of ways, he was a Governor Reynolds planted lobbyist. So he, I mean, he's not there to represent the community. He's there to represent the $1 million at his school that he has now created. I mean, this school would not exist but for vouchers. This
Totally.
school would not exist unless Dean did, and I'm going to read from your complaint because I think it's important. In a news article from the North Tama Telegraph, January 18th, 2024, quote, new K through 8th private Christian school aims to start classes in Tama company in 20 a county in 2024. Tama Toledo Christian School, helmed by Board President Representative Dean Fisher. So he's taking total credit. It didn't exist. I'm a state rep and I'm starting the school, and aren't you happy? Because it's a Christian school. But that's not bad enough. Then it goes on. Our funding falls into two categories. All right, now take notes, everyone. The startup expenses to get us to the first day of school in 2025 and operating expenses from the first day on are the following. Our startup expenses are expected to be slightly over $100,000. Now, that $100,000 sounds like a lot of money, but it's not too hard to raise $100,000. I mean, you got a couple of people, you maybe have one deep pocket, and you can write a check for $100,000, remember? I mean, they can write it off as a charitable contribution. I mean, it's a win-win for some like rich guy. Anyway, so now we know that they're going to have to raise the $100,000. These funds will come from fundraising events, donations by community members and churches, corporations that wish to support the effort, and grants from organizations that wish to support Christian school startups like ours. Now, here is the bold line that everyone needs to understand, but you don't really care about the $100,000 because that's just, it's pocket change. Once we start classes, the ESA funding, which are the vouchers, will pay the bulk of our operating expenses. And what is he referring to? The approximately $1 million a year that they will now use of public dollars to pay for this Christian private school that basically, I mean, remember, he's in the legislature. The school didn't exist. He was courted by Governor Reynolds. He supports these vouchers. And then no sooner does he get the vouchers and bingo, here comes the school. Now, I guess my only question is the following. He's a slug. There's no question about it. It feels corrupt. It sounds corrupt. But my concern is this, and maybe Hugh, you can answer this question. Even though Dean did something that I think is really disreputable, even if he wasn't there, Hugh, wouldn't the voucher bill still have passed? So he wasn't pivotal. It didn't pass by one vote. It was a supermajority Republican. Governor Reynolds knew exactly who she was picking to make sure that she could get her voucher bill through. Was it that close that Dean's vote was essential to its passage, or was it sort of icing on the cake? And now he gets to bake the cake, put the icing on, serve it up, give them ice cream. I mean, it's the whole thing is gross. But I guess my concern about your raising this ethics question is, yes, it appears unethical, but is it really unethical when you actually look at how so many bills become law and people benefit by the legislation they actually work on and pass?
Well, what's right is right, and what's wrong is wrong, and this is wrong. And it's just like, and you're absolutely correct, Arnie. There's lots of things that are wrong. This is one that it's very glaring. As Tim said, he campaigned on him, he voted for him, and now he's trying to cash in on him to the tune of about $1 million a year. So again, what's right is right, and what's wrong is wrong. And we're about good government. We want government. CCI wants government of, by, and for the people, that serves the common good, the public interest, not the private interest, not the interest of Dean Fisher and his board out there in Tama County to set up this Christian school. So and so our signal is, and we're going to fight tooth and nail on this, and our, we want to send a message to other state legislators specifically on this issue. If you're going to vote for vouchers and they're going to use them personally for your family or specific projects, we're going to be on it, and we're going to be raising this issue, and we're going to be mobilizing and engaging lots of people around the state to say, this is not right. And we're going to fight tooth and nail for good government.
Well, and here's where you have, I think, this is such a perfect story to share, because we already know that, you know, in Republican Iowa, the election of consequence is not the November election. The election of consequence is the primary. And now the governor has weighed in. And what I think you need to do is she weighed in for vouchers, or is she weighed in for corruption? Has she weighed in for kit? No. I'm sorry. You've got to ask the question, because that's really what this is. And then you go back to primary voters, and you go to primary voters in other districts around the state, and you show them what ultimately is happening. And most people, my understanding is, Tim, as the 62% say, don't like the idea of vouchers. They actually believe in their public schools. And as you heard from Hugh and Tim, you can support this, is that those schools in rural districts are the primary employer. They're not only the primary employer, they're where the community comes together. It's where you see your kids succeed. It is so much more than a school. It is the Velcro in those rural communities. And the whole point of vouchers is to destroy that. And then what's worse, Tim, is what you see with this guy, Dean Fisher, is that not only do they destroy it with vouchers, but they aid and abet people that have a financial agenda to use public dollars to enhance their reputation and basically their wish list, and not the wish list of Iowa voters. It is so disgusting, but I think other Republicans in Iowa have to start getting nervous, because you're going to turn all of them into Dean Fisher. Because frankly, they all are Dean Fisher if this is the kind of bills they're supporting and this is the consequence of those bills. You should basically start creating a new word. Or are you pulling a Fisher? Are you pulling a Fisher? And actually make it a poison pill referred to as a Dean Fisher, because Dean Fisher is a slug. He doesn't care about kids. He doesn't care about education. He basically wants to enhance something that is not about what's good for Iowa. It ultimately is only good for Dean Fisher and this dream that he wants to create that isn't really about education. It's more about playing the Christian card than the education card. Oh my God, I'm so appalled, Tim. So again, how is this complaint been received? What's the status going forward, Tim?
Yeah, the complaint, you know, we haven't heard from the House Ethics Committee yet, or Fisher. He hasn't responded to the complaint. But yeah, the, you know, public schools are laboratories for democracy, and it's a great place for, you know, kids from diverse backgrounds to come together and, you know, learn to live with each other. And, you know, what Fisher wants to do is, you know, antithetical to that. And even Reynolds' own people are not supportive of her. We've had 3 Department of Education directors in the past 2 years. So we've had 2 resign, and our current one, I think, has been there for almost a year now. But yeah, she's really, you know, creating a culture of fear in our schools. And kind of our next step is we want to file an addendum to our ethics complaint with signatures from people in Iowa in support of the complaint. So right now we're gathering signatures to add to our complaint. Just to demonstrate, you know, how unpopular the vouchers are, but also how wrong what Fisher is doing. It doesn't make sense for people in Iowa.
I really do think you need to start calling it, are you going to pull a Fisher?
And you start, I love you, that. I mean, that's great.
I know, listen, this is what I do for a living, you. I mean, I'm always figuring out, okay, how do I make people understand how wrong this is? This is wrong on every level. And you put down the action requested by Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. I want people to know what this complaint is asking for. You are asking, 1, to tell Representative Fisher that he cannot discuss, lobby for, or vote on any future bill or legislation that continues or expands voucher benefits. Unfortunately, I think the cow has left the barn. But anyway, I'll take that one. 2, tell Representative Fisher that he cannot use vouchers for his private school. Now that's got some teeth. I like that one. All right. 3, tell Representative Fisher that if he continues to serve as board president of the, how is he pronounced it? Tama Toledo Christian School using vouchers, he needs to resign from the House. Oh, I like that one too. And 4, Tell other House members that they can't use voucher money to send their children or grandchildren to private schools. Using a public position for private gain is a direct ethics violation. Cashing in on vouchers by those who use their power and authority to put them into place violates the principles of ethical government and the foundations of our democracy. Oh my God. We know what's going on here, but in a lot of ways, Governor Reynolds has gone more to an extreme on vouchers than virtually any other governor in the country. So I want everyone to follow what's going on in Iowa, because the nightmare is happening now. The nightmare is happening now. You keep hearing about it. So I guess I have to ask a little bit more about the details of the voucher bill. So I know, for example, in my state, we have vouchers, okay? Well, they call them educational freedom accounts. I don't know what they call them. Anyway, and the push has always been to increase the amount of money going into the individual voucher and to increase who can actually access the voucher.
Yep.
You know, initially it was decided, oh, it's really to allow poor kids to be on a level playing field with rich kids so that they then will be able to get money so they have choice in education. That was the rationale. And then we began to realize that they bastardized that rationale because they kept upping the ante for who in fact would be qualified for these vouchers. And then you find out, as you find out in Iowa, the percentage, 2/3 of people who are getting the vouchers are already in the private institutions or the religious institutions. They didn't need these vouchers for choice. They'd already exercised their choice and were there. So I guess I'm going to ask you, Hugh, what are the limitations on who can access a voucher in Iowa? Are there any, or have they increased over time?
I'm going to kick that one to Tim. Tim is more of our expert on that. But the answer is it's going to go up in value and it's going to be available pretty much here in 2 years to everybody. But Tim, what are the particulars on the voucher program?
Yeah, so for the first year, your family has to be at 300% or below of the federal poverty level. And then next year, it goes up to 400%. And then year three, there's no cap. So millionaires in Iowa can use vouchers to send their kids to private schools.
Oh, Arnie, this year too, Tim, how much more money do they want to put into the voucher program this year? It was like 130 some odd million or...
Yeah, so I think the cost for this first year is about $130 million in vouchers. And then next year, Governor Reynolds plans to boost that up to $180 million of voucher dollars. So yeah, it's really going to
expand. It's an increase.
Increasing year one to year two.
And it's just, Arnie, I think the way that Reynolds sees this and others, like, the sky's the limit. And why do I do it? Because I can do it. And I can basically put my ideology on everybody and control how people think and live.
So are there any, so I know in New Hampshire, and that's why, again, I need to ask this question. In New Hampshire, you can use the education freedom accounts or the vouchers for public school, not for public school, for private school, for religious schools, and for homeschoolers. Are you able to use your education voucher money for homeschoolers? Because what's so interesting about the homeschoolers is, let's say you've got four kids and you're homeschooling them and you're getting like $8,000 or $9,000. I mean, you're getting paid better to homeschool than a teacher's getting with, you know, 22 kids in a class and having to do a lesson plan. So I'm kind of curious, what are the limits, not just financially of the 300% to 400%, but are there any limits as to where these vouchers can be used? Tim, what do we do?
Yeah, so we don't have the homeschool expansion yet. And we don't have preschool. Okay. But those are like ideas that are out there that I'm sure Reynolds and her allies in the legislature want to pass. Wow. So it is a little narrower than some of the other states right now, but we anticipate that's coming next.
Well, for example, I know that you can use the vouchers to buy computers. You can use the vouchers to pay for like educational trips. You know what I mean? It's like, good. Let's go to Disney World and let's see. I know we can go check out the fish. You know what I mean? I mean, it's so unaccountable. There is so little in the way of not only accountability and transparency that it's kind of shocking. And then again, we were talking to some folks about the chaplains in the schools in Texas and the idea that they want to put chaplains in schools instead of guidance counselors. You know, the chaplains can go into schools, and there's a satanic temple that can't wait. They're like, oh, we got chaplains. We got chaplains. I'm sure we got people that we can send in. So again, I just want people to know when there is no accountability, when there are no limits, you have no idea what's being taught. It could be neo-Nazis that are setting up these private schools. And again, you write, I mean, it's not just the madrasa that everybody uses because there's this, you know, anti-Muslim, anti-Islam. I mean, I just want people to know that the sky is the limit. And you think that you have some idea about what the choice is, but you don't. And then ultimately, the last point I want to make for both you and Tim is that people keep thinking that it is a choice for parents. It's actually a choice for schools, because schools don't have to say yes to every child. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. It isn't about parental choice. It's now about schools that become the gatekeeper. They can right. say yes, and they can say no. So the fiction is the word choice. It's not your choice. It's that private or religious school's choice and not yours. Right. Oh my God, Hugh. I hope this story gets some national traction. I actually sent this article about the complaint to some folks that write for education at Forbes magazine, because I want this story to be told, because it's not gonna stay in Iowa. It will be expanded in many other places. So thank you so much for doing this, and good luck to see what happens when the legislature has to deal with this complaint.
Thank you.
It's powerful.
Thank you. All right, everyone. Appreciate it.
Oh, please. My pleasure. Anyway, this, everyone, is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We've been talking about vouchers with two people that care a heck of a lot about making sure that they don't destroy public education. Tim Glaser joined CCI staff in 2017, and Hugh Espy is a longtime member of the CCI staff team. He actually was their executive director from 2003 to 2023. They care about the community. They care about education. They care about Iowa. All right, everyone. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. This is Arnie. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think. Let your mind go. Let yourself be free. Let's go back. Let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you. You couldn't have been too much more than 10.